Well, Giorgio said, you're lucky they didn't bring down the whole cavern around your ears.
Just my day, I guess.
He gestured toward the ledge.
I don't suppose they left much up there, did they?
I doubt it, but the forensic techs are checking everything.
Rubbing the side of his head, which still ached even with the medication Bridges gave him, Lorca said,
until I see proof, Kodos isn't dead.
Doubt clouded Giorgio's features. I don't think the thermite left all that much.
Proof, or we keep going, he said with total seriousness. After everything that's happened, nothing less than absolute confirmation of his death is sufficient.
He glanced once more to the ledge.
If he's not up there, then I'm getting my gear and we're starting this all over again.
Commander Giorgio!
It was Captain Coropati crossing the cavern toward her. He was walking alongside Governor Gisella Ribeiro and another man in a Starfleet captain's uniform. The man, in his mid to late 40s, was tall and fit, with wavy auburn hair that, to Giorgio's eyes, was somewhat longer than regulations typically allowed. His brown eyes burned with the intensity and wisdom earned from a long Starfleet career, but Giorgio thought there was a bit of playfulness there, too. She guessed he commanded one of the two starships that had assumed orbit above Tarsus IV just over an hour earlier. Captain, she said, nodding to Coropati while noting that Lorca had pushed himself to his feet. She offered greetings to Ribeiro before turning her gaze to the other command officer.
I'm sorry, sir. We've not met. Commander Philippa Giorgio, temporarily assigned to the Narbonne under Captain Coropati.
The other man smiled as they shook hands.
Oh, I know very well who you are, Commander.
He extended his right hand.
Robert April, USS Enterprise.
His British accent was crisp, though there was also a lilt in his voice that gave it a youthful quality despite his apparent age.
As I was telling Aurobindo, you've done tremendous work here.
His gaze shifted to Lorca, and he offered his hand again.
Commander Lorca, it's good to meet you as well. I only wish it was under better circumstances.
As do I, Captain, replied the commander. Still, we're damned glad to see you.
April said, we come bearing gifts, after a fashion. Food stores for the entire colony, for starters. They'll want for nothing. It's the least we can do.
We've also brought a full staff of grief counselors and other therapists, and we're prepared to ferry anyone who needs additional or extended medical attention to Starbase 11 or their destination of choice.
He shook his head. None of that comes anywhere close to compensating these people for their losses. But it's a start, and hopefully it shows that somebody gives a damn about them, the way you've obviously been demonstrating. You lot have left me with tremendous shoes to fill. I hope my crew and I can measure up.
Taking that as an apparent cue, Ribeiro stepped toward Lorca. Commander, I wanted to thank you personally for everything you've done for us. It's a debt we'll never be able to repay.
She reached for his hand, taking it in both of hers.
I've been made aware of the personal loss you've suffered, as well as the deaths of your fellow Starfleet officers. You have my deepest sympathies.
Thank you, Governor, said Lorca. I appreciate you making time for me. As for the rest of it,
he cast his gaze toward the cavern floor.
I was just doing my duty, the same as Captain Coropati, Commander Giorgio, and the rest of the Narbonne crew.
It was not a jest when I said filling your shoes was a tall order, said April. You all have accomplished so much in such a short period.
He looked to Ribeiro. Governor, that the colony is far more stable than I expected to see upon arriving is a testament to the people themselves, but also your leadership.
More the former, Captain, replied Ribeiro. We've been through a lot, and I need to earn back the trust of my fellow citizens, but we'll persevere, and this colony will soon be thriving once again. I've never been prouder of this community than I am now.
April nodded in unabashed approval.
And the progress being made toward isolating and fighting the contagion is most impressive. My chief medical officer expects to have a viable counteragent ready to deploy in less than a week.
but that wouldn't be possible without the work you started. I long ago learned to take whatever estimate she provides for anything as nothing less than the gospel truth.
For future reference, said Koropati, the Enterprise's chief medical officer is also the good captain's wife.
Sarah.
April smiled.
Captain Koropati's statement makes mine no less true.
Activity elsewhere in the cavern caught their notice, and Giorgio saw a pair of Starfleet officers, both dressed in pale blue coveralls, emerging from the space above the cave floor. She recognized them as the civilian forensic technicians dispatched by Koropati as part of the team sent to support Lorca and his search party. Rather than using the crude ladder rungs hammered into the rock wall, the techs were descending a ramp installed to facilitate movement to and from the cave floor. Between them was an anti-gravity sled, atop which rested a black bag that Giorgio knew was large enough to accommodate a humanoid, but which appeared to contain something far smaller. Once on the floor, one of the technicians, a woman of Latino descent, made her way toward Ribeiro and the group of officers.
"Good morning," she said by way of introduction. "My name is Amelia Cardoso. I'm a forensic pathologist. I know you've been waiting for information, and I'll give you what I have." She gestured to the ledge. "We found two bodies up there. Both human, one male, the other female. There wasn't much left. As you can imagine, the thermite was pretty efficient, though we were able to secure genetic samples from both victims."
Lorca, stepping closer, asked, "Were you able to make an identification?"
"Yes. The woman's name is Fiona Okafor. According to the colony administration databases, she's a maintenance worker assigned to one of the city's hydroponics farms."
Cardoso paused, and Giorgio saw something in the woman's eyes. Relief? Sadness? Some odd combination of those two emotions?
"The man is Adrian Kodos."
Giorgio asked, "You're certain?"
"As certain as we can be."
Reaching into a pocket of her overalls, Cardoso extracted a compact medical scanner. "We were able to run genetic comparisons between samples retrieved here and the colony medical databases. It's a match, no question. We can run more comprehensive tests once we take the bodies back to a proper lab, but even our field tests are 99% reliable."
"It would be good to share this news with the colony," said Ribeiro. "I'd like to make a formal address later this morning."
Lorca asked, "Is that wise, Governor? I mean, if we're not absolutely sure?"
"Regardless of the less-than-ideal outcome," said Koropati, "the people need to know that there's a resolution to all of this. While it would have been preferable to have Kodos stand trial, this still provides a measure of closure."
"I believe you're right," added Captain April. "For the good of the community, I don't think you should sit on this."
Giorgio eyed Lorca. "Are you okay with this?"
"I suppose I'll have to be."
The commander frowned.
"After everything that's happened, it just doesn't seem real somehow."
April said, "It seems real enough to me."
"Indeed."
Ribeiro placed a hand on Lorca's arm.
"You can stop worrying about this, Commander. You've done us a great service. Thanks to you, Kodos is gone forever."
"But he still has supporters, Governor," countered Lorca. "Maybe we got the most committed followers. But what about those who cowered in the dark, silently cheering on the bastard and those who helped him? Those are the same people who celebrated your removal from office and got behind Kodos, whether or not they were brave enough to demonstrate that allegiance. What about them?"
"It's a complicated question, Commander," replied Ribeiro. "And it's not one we'll answer today. We'll find those people sooner or later, but for now, you've earned yourself a much-deserved rest."
Despite the praise and assurances which Lorca accepted with aplomb, Giorgio saw that the man was not convinced. Something, whether it was determination, anger, dissatisfaction, or simple grief, was gnawing at him, and he would have to purge these personal demons in his own way and in his own time. Sooner or later he would come to accept what science and common sense were trying to tell him. Adrian Kodos was dead. 37. Containers of varying sizes covered most of the warehouse's floor. Some stood alone, while others were stacked atop one another or occupied shelving units along the walls or arranged in rows and clusters. From where she stood on a catwalk extending from the warehouse's second level, Giorgio regarded the haphazard maze in which one could lose themselves if they were not careful. Whether issued by one of the Federation colony support entities or provided by the Narbonne or the other Starfleet vessels providing assistance, each crate, capsule, or other vessel held within it the household effects and other personal items of someone taken far too soon. Though hundreds of such parcels were amassed here, Giorgio knew there would be many more coming in the days ahead. Teams of people were working around the clock to inventory and package the possessions of each slain colonist, ensuring that everything was handled in a careful, reverent manner as it was prepared for transport. Each item would be delivered to family members or other designated parties, carrying with them fond memories, as well as the embodiment of loss. From experience, Giorgio knew such keepsakes would forever harbor a dull, lingering ache of grief, but also, if the fates were kind, some small measure of closure. The full magnitude of the tragedy inflicted upon the people of Tarsus IV was put into some semblance of perspective. While the amphitheater offered its own perspective on the horror unleashed there, this vast sea of orphaned belongings was a blunt, profound indicator of the sheer number of lives so monstrously ended. To Giorgio, it was a hammer striking without mercy, demanding that the senselessness of the atrocity committed here should neither be forgotten nor repeated.
Never again. We owe these people at least that much.
Not just them, she reminded herself. There were the men and women who died later, after the executions, as a consequence of the hunt for Kodos. Their sacrifices also needed to be observed and honored. Footsteps on the catwalk to her left made Giorgio turn to see Gabriel Lorca walking in her direction. Like her, he wore a dress uniform suitable for the day's observances. His beard stubble was gone, and he had received a haircut, so he now presented the epitome of a squared-away Starfleet officer.
"Commander," he said by way of greeting, "I was told you wanted to see me."
"Yes. Thank you for coming. I saw you at the memorial. I wanted to say again how sorry I am for your loss."
Lorca nodded.
"Thank you."
Rather than sit with the Narbonne crew who were mourning the deaths of their own people, he, Lieutenant Asal Sultani, and Ensign Terry Bridges had instead attended the service with a small group of colonists, which Giorgio assumed to be friends or other acquaintances. Given Lorca's relationship with one of the women who perished, this was more than understandable.
"I thought it was a lovely service," said Giorgio.
Lorca nodded but did not reply, and she saw the pain that still lingered in the man's eyes. She also noted something else. Was it acceptance, or perhaps resignation? After all, he had to know why she had called him here. "I let you continue the search for Kodos even though we both knew you weren't at your best. You were carrying a lot of emotional baggage, Commander, but I want to believe you when you tell me you didn't let your grief affect the way you carried out your duty."
Frowning, Lorca replied, "It didn't."
"You're sure?"
"I won't deny I was personally affected by all of this, but everyone who died here, the colonists, Migen and Piotr, Jason Geiler, Belena, all of them, deserved nothing less than the full measure of justice."
Lorca looked away, casting his gaze over the warehouse floor. "I don't know that we'll ever be able to provide that for them in the proper measure, but hopefully it was enough so that they can rest a bit more peacefully."
"Did your feelings get in the way of bringing Kodos to justice?"
Anger flashed in Lorca's eyes.
"If you're asking whether I deliberately killed him, Commander, the answer is no. Do I regret that he didn't live to stand trial? Of course. But am I sorry he's dead? Absolutely not."
Persuaded by his answers, Giorgio had to acknowledge that Lorca had done a tremendous, even superhuman job keeping his personal feelings at bay while carrying out the task of hunting Kodos and his followers.
It was easy in hindsight to see how much the effort weighed on him, and yet he had soldiered on, putting aside grief and even a desire for vengeance in order to complete the assignment given to him. With the mission over, Kodos was gone, and some small parcel of justice had been served, Giorgio wondered if Lorca might finally allow himself to mourn.
"What's next for you?" she asked.
"They're temporarily assigning a new staff to the outpost. The four of us are to report to Starbase 11 for a debriefing and extended shore leave. That's probably for the best, I think." What he did not say, and what Giorgio knew, was the outpost's surviving team members, and Lorca in particular, would undergo psychological evaluation in order to determine if there might be any residual and potentially harmful consequences to what they had endured. Such reviews were normal after any personal loss, and varied in scope and intensity depending on the nature of the incident in question. As for the remaining colonists, several hundred were scheduled for transport away from Tarsus IV at their request, aboard either the Narbonne or one of the other ships attached to the relief effort. She was not surprised to hear that the overwhelming majority of the population was electing to remain. The reasons varied, of course, from a desire to maintain some connection to a lost loved one to a simple wish to not feel as though they were being forced from the home they had made here, to a renewed commitment to the goals embodied by the colony and the potential it represented. There was much encouragement and inspiration to be taken from that.
"What about you, Commander?" asked Lorca. "Where are you headed?"
"I was on my way to the Defiant before all of this. I suspect that's where I'll end up once we're back at Starbase 11 and I get my debriefing."
So hectic was the situation since arriving on Tarsus IV that there was little to no time to consider her pending new duty assignment. The science vessel was a good posting, and would provide all manner of new challenges unlike those faced aboard a patrol ship. What she learned aboard the Defiant would offer insight into another aspect of Starfleet's overall mission of exploration and the expansion of knowledge. The experience would serve her well as she continued her pursuit of one day commanding a ship of her own.
"But enough about me. I haven't asked how you're doing," she said.
Lorca replied, "I've already had an extensive conversation with Captain Kurapati about all of this. As I told him, the mission is over. Kodos is dead. I know there are those who would have preferred he was brought back to stand trial. I understand their feelings, and as a Starfleet officer I did everything in my power to affect that outcome. But Kodos made his choice. He pushed the fight, and he's dead as a result. As far as any official reports are concerned, I'm disappointed that he died before we could take him into custody, and saddened that our attempts to capture him resulted in the loss of even a single life."
"But unofficially?"
"I'm sorry he didn't burn longer and live while doing it." Her eyebrows rising at the cold, harsh truth lacing his words, Giorgio nodded.
"Best to keep that out of the report."
"Absolutely." Then Lorca offered a small smile. "I appreciate your concern, Commander. Honestly, and I'd be lying if I told you I'm fine and there's nothing to worry about. The truth is that I'm a long way from being fine. But I'm better than I was a few days ago. A few days from now, I'll be better still. But I know it will be a while before I get past it." He placed his hand on the catwalk's guardrail. "I may never be completely past it. Belena was something very special." The smile returned, and Giorgio could tell it was not forced for her benefit. "She was everything I wasn't. Spontaneous, serene, maybe even a little too wild on occasion. Belena was a free spirit and a caring soul unlike anyone I've ever known. She was a descendant of the original settlers, but she wasn't caught up in all of the isolationist talk and the movement to declare the planet free of Federation oversight. When relocation happened, she was one of the strongest supporters once the influx of refugees started. There were all kinds of committees and task groups designed to help with the transition into the community, and from what her friends told me, I think she volunteered for all of them." He paused, his features softening as though he was recalling a pleasant memory.
"I wish I could have met her," offered Giorgio.
You'd have liked her. She made me want to be a better person, to do something worthwhile with my life, and maybe even make life just a little better for someone else. Lorca was staring ahead, though perhaps not focusing on anything in particular, and Giorgio heard him utter a short, quiet laugh. She convinced me to try orbital skydiving. Do you know how insane and ridiculous that sounds to me? I would never have done something like that before meeting her. I wouldn't have tried a lot of things before meeting her. He sighed. Belena was good for me.
She still is, replied Giorgio. She sounds like an amazing person, and it's obvious she had an influence on you beyond the obvious attraction. You haven't given yourself the time to properly mourn her, but now you can. Do that. Hold on to the good things, and don't let what you shared go to waste, Commander.
Returning his attention to her, Lorca cocked an eyebrow. After everything we've been through, ranks seem a little stuffy, Philippa. I'm Gabriel.
Don't let everything you shared with Belena go to waste, Gabriel. For her sake.
Lorca straightened his posture. I don't plan to. I just don't know how to go about it. For a while, I was even considering leaving Starfleet to stay here with her. He shook his head. Staying here doesn't seem right anymore, but I'm not sure Starfleet is the right place for me anymore either.
Starfleet needs good officers like you, Giorgio countered. They've also invested a great deal into your training and career. It'd be a shame if you didn't give them an opportunity to get a decent return on that investment.
She suspected he knew this, just as she suspected he knew that he still had much to offer Starfleet. While some joined the service because they wanted to or believed they could contribute to something greater than themselves, there were those who answered what they felt was a higher calling, a mandate or even destiny of sorts, for which an ordinary life would never be able to offer a worthy substitute. Did Gabriel Lorca view Starfleet this way? Of that, Giorgio could not be sure. In her experience, it was a question best asked and answered by the person it most directly affected.
Deep down, I know you're right, said Lorca, just as I know it's likely the best place for me. I can't run away from what happened or go hide somewhere and hope for the pain to pass or that I might forget. I don't want to forget.
He gestured to the warehouse floor. And I don't want this to happen anywhere else. Behind the grief he still felt, Giorgio heard his conviction. With only her gut instincts to guide her, she felt he would not turn his back on Starfleet. However, what he endured here would stay with him. His heart had hardened in the face of what he had suffered and lost, and in the actions he had taken to bring Kodos to justice. The experience would fade, but would always lurk just within the shadows. It would forever weigh on him without his conscious knowledge, the way living through any extreme event affected a person's psyche. How Lorca accepted or rejected this unavoidable change within would define the type of person he was to be from this time forward.
Ever since that last fight with Kodos and his people, he said, I've been asking myself how things might have gone differently. I honestly did want to bring him in. I wanted the families and friends of those he killed to see him, along with those who helped him, face the full weight of Federation justice. But there was a small part of me that just didn't care.
He turned to meet her gaze, and an even smaller part that wished I could have killed him with my bare hands. It would have been wrong, and I'd like to think reason and duty would have won out, but if I had it to do over again, I wonder what I would have done.
Giorgio shook her head. I think you know.
She looked toward the containers of personal effects. Upholding a set of ideals can be difficult, and sometimes it's damned cruel. Being able to do that, especially during times of adversity and crisis and even great personal tragedy, is the true test of anyone privileged to wear this. Reaching up, she tapped her chest to indicate her Starfleet uniform. We're bound to uphold and defend those ideals, but the harder job is living up to them. His expression falling, Lorca said, I don't know if I'm capable of that anymore.
He sighed. For that matter,
I don't know if I ever was.
Belena knew.
Giorgio smiled.
Something tells me the woman you described was a pretty good judge of character, and wouldn't bother with someone who wasn't of a mind similar to hers. What do you think she'd say to you if she were here?
Again, Lorca smiled. That I should quit sulking and get back to work.
Sounds like good advice, Giorgio decided. For all of us.
38. Resisting the urge to grab onto a handrail or anything else to help her maintain her balance, Giorgio waited for the turbulence engulfing the Narbonne to wane as it clawed upward through the last vestiges of Tarsus IV's atmosphere and pushed into open space. Her stomach was the first to register the almost imperceptible shift when the vessel's artificial gravity systems kicked in, replacing the natural pull of the planet itself.
"We've achieved orbit," reported Lieutenant Melissa Parham from where she sat at the helm console. "Securing launch thrusters and adjusting trajectory for standard orbit departure course."
Seated in his chair at the center of the bridge, Captain Koropati said,
"Nicely done, Lieutenant. Commander Larson, secure from atmospheric operations, and let's get ready to head home."
"Aye, sir,"
replied the Narbonne's first officer from where she sat at the aft engineering monitoring station. She tapped the control to activate the ship's intercom.
"Commander Larson to all hands. Commence post-launch systems checks."
Koropati turned in his chair to face Giorgio, who managed to withstand the atmospheric buffeting without resorting to taking a seat. Smiling at her, he said,
"You are getting the hang of this, Commander. We may just make a planet hopper out of you yet."
He gestured toward the screen.
"However, I promise it'll be smooth sailing from here on out."
"Sounds good to me, Captain."
The return trip to Starbase 11 promised to be routine, followed by whatever debriefing schedule awaited her with officials from Starfleet Command who still were trying to wrap their heads around everything that had transpired on Tarsus IV. According to a message from Admiral Anderson, her assignment to the USS Defiant was still on track, with her orders revised to include the layover at the Starbase. At this point, she was looking forward to starship duty. The demands placed upon the first officer of a science vessel were bound to be less taxing than what she and the rest of the Narbonne crew had just undergone.
"Don't jinx it."
At the communications console, Ensign Richard Doherty turned in his seat.
"Captain, we're being hailed by the Enterprise."
Pushing himself from his chair, Koropati stepped around the helm console, putting himself directly in front of the main view screen before gesturing to the younger officer.
"Put it on screen."
A moment later, the image of Tarsus IV and the space beyond the curve of the planet disappeared, replaced by the visage of Robert April. Now that he was back aboard the welcoming environs of his own ship, April was making good on the reputation that preceded him. Giorgio almost smiled at his nod to eccentricity, with the captain sporting a woolly gray cardigan, the front of which was open to reveal his Starfleet uniform tunic. His hands were jammed into its pockets, giving him something of a professorial appearance that was exacerbated by his unkempt hair. Behind April, the Enterprise bridge was a hive of color and activity, with men and women manning consoles that seemed jammed to overflowing with controls and display screens.
"Arobindo,"
said April, offering a smile as he eschewed proper protocol.
"I just wanted to wish you and your crew safe travels."
"Thank you, Captain. It's been an honor to work with you. I just wish the circumstances could have been better."
"Likewise. You and your people can be proud of the work you've done here. There's still a lot left to do, but we wouldn't be anywhere we are without everything you did. I suspect a great many souls of the dead, as well as the living, will rest just a bit easier, thanks to you."
Though she was anxious to get on with her next assignment, the part of Giorgio wanted to remain on Tarsus IV to see how things progressed in the weeks and months to come. The people of New Anchorage and the other settlements were well on their way to returning to their normal lives, but the scars left by Kodos would be a long time healing. Several of his supporters were aboard the Narbonne, berthed in isolated quarters and under constant watch by the ship's security detail. At Starbase 11,
They would be remanded to station security while they awaited trial. Georgiou would be keeping tabs on those proceedings, as well as checking on the planet and the status of the recovery effort.
"Between Governor Ribeiro, her people, and you and the other ships helping her out, I think Tarsus IV is in good hands, sir," said Koropati. "Best of luck to all of you."
April smiled.
"Fair winds and following seas, Narbon. This is Enterprise, signing off."
The connection was severed and April disappeared, returning the main screen to its image of the planet. Only now, Ensign Doherty had engaged the Narbon sensors to provide a view of the Enterprise as it pursued its own standard orbit of Tarsus IV. It was Georgiou's first up-close look at a Constitution-class starship, and the mighty vessel was a sight to behold.
"I guess that's the future. That's my future."
Excusing herself from the bridge, Georgiou headed down the companionway toward the crew recreation and mess areas. Her stomach reminded her that she had missed breakfast, and it was well past time to correct that oversight. With no official duties awaiting her now that the Narbonne was on its way to Starbase 11, the only activities demanding her attention were the after-action reports she would be submitting to Admiral Anderson and Starfleet Command, and precisely none of those appealed to her. On the other hand, a workout in the ship's gym, followed by a long, hot shower and a nap, held greater attraction.
"Come to think of it, that nap's sounding better by the minute."
"Commander!"
The young voice stopped Georgiou in her tracks, and she returned to the corridor junction she had just passed to see Shannon Moulton, familiar Andorian plush doll in hand, running toward her. Shannon's mother, Eliana, followed close behind, smiling in apparent embarrassment.
"Shannon," said Georgiou, "what are you doing up here?"
From what she had been told, civilians were not supposed to be allowed into this part of the ship. Blissfully unaware of any protocols she may have been breaching, the girl ran up to Georgiou and wrapped her short arms around Georgiou's legs.
"I apologize, Commander," said Eliana. "Commander Larson said it would be all right if we came up here to find you. Shannon's been wanting to see you."
Dropping to a knee so that she was eye-level with the girl, Georgiou smiled.
"I didn't get to see you before we left, but I knew we'd run into each other sooner or later. It's not that big a ship, after all. So what brings you up here?"
"We're going to see my grandparents," replied Shannon,
changing the topic of discussion with no effort in that way only children could.
"They live on Mars."
Georgiou had seen the Moultons in the boarding area at the spaceport prior to the Narbonne's departure. A quick check of the status reports from the colony informed her that Shannon and her mother were among those opting to leave Tarsus IV in favor of a fresh start. No doubt, Eliana Moulton was hoping to bury the pain and grief she felt at the loss of her husband. Shannon, on the other hand, was insulated from that anguish thanks to the merciful innocence of childhood. It would be a while before she came to understand what she had survived and why her father had not.
"If you're going to Mars," said Georgiou, "then you should ask Captain Koropati about it. He was born there, you know."
Eliana replied, "We'll be sure to do that. Shannon, don't you have something for Commander Georgiou?" Instead of replying, Shannon held up the doll in her right hand. The stuffed Andorian companion now sported two antennae thanks to Georgiou's repair efforts, and she noted that it had been cleaned since she last saw it.
"I want you to take him. Maybe he can bring you luck now."
The simple gesture was enough to elicit tears, and Georgiou reached up to wipe her eyes.
"Thank you, sweetheart. I promise to take good care of him."
Reaching to brush the girl's hair, she marveled at how this child had somehow weathered everything cruel fate had thrown at her. It gave Georgiou hope that everyone who had survived the Tarsus IV incident, along with those who came to help, might learn to live with what they experienced. She gazed at the doll. While it represented enormous loss, perhaps it also served as a reminder for the future. Despite the actions of Kodos and his followers, Georgiou remained heartened by how so many of the colonists were able to come together in the face of such tragedy and help one another. Her belief in the empathy and willingness of intelligent beings to bond even during times of extreme hardship may have been tested, but not broken. Could anything positive come from what the Tarsus IV colonists experienced? At the moment, Giorgio was hard-pressed to see what or how that might happen, but Shannon Moulton gave her hope. After promising the girl and her mother to meet up again on Starbase 11, Giorgio took her leave of the Moultons and started back down the passageway. Descending to the crew level, she passed the large open area of deck space that housed the ship's gymnasium and other recreational facilities. Separate rooms around the larger chamber's perimeter offered a small library and audio-visual entertainment alcoves, all of it surrounding a collection of fitness equipment. A few members of the Narbonne's crew were working out on different machines, while one man stood alone on the room's opposite side, exercising in frenetic fashion against a person-sized mannequin designed for boxing and other hand-to-hand combat training. The man was attacking the simulated opponent with what Giorgio thought to be barely restrained fury. It was Gabriel Lorca. He landed punch after punch, feeling the training model's padded synthetic outer shell give beneath his knuckles with each impact. Every landed strike elicited a tone, indicating a point added to his score. Lorca preferred training simulations like this one to simple boxing bags for the feeling of facing off against an actual person. The mannequins could be programmed to simulate any of over 100 different humanoid life forms, presenting each species' respective vulnerable or soft spots and adjusting the difficult setting automatically. For sessions like this, Lorca normally preferred to square off against a Klingon simulation, which tended to present one of the program's more challenging options. Today, however, he had elected to combat a standard Earth human. Whereas the computer assigned no identity to his manufactured opponent, Lorca already had a particular persona in mind. Not satisfied with standard boxing training, he had switched to a sparring method first learned years earlier before joining Starfleet. A mix of techniques mastered in martial arts classes during his youth was later augmented by his academy and security school training. He had taken to it all, relishing the challenge of developing his skills to their limit and testing them against his instructors and other opponents. The victories in such situations were rewarding, but so too were the defeats, as he almost always came away from those matches having learned something new about himself or discovering yet another improvement he might pursue. Another thing he had learned over the years was that there was a time and place for form and technique, usually in a training dojo or formal competition. When it came to real-world situations, Lorca preferred a blended fighting style that relied on fast, violent attacks designed to incapacitate his opponent as quickly as possible. Then there were the times when he just wanted to beat on something. He shifted his attack away from the mannequin's torso, focusing each strike on the target's head. The pings announcing points augmenting his score meant nothing. Tones bleating that he had landed blows sufficient to stun or even kill his imaginary opponent went unheeded. All he saw was Kodos, the face of the executioner, pummeled and bleeding at his hands. Every strike was retribution. Every perceived cry of pain or plea for mercy was fuel to drive Lorca harder. "You got off lucky, you bastard." Lorca pressed the assault, holding the vision of Kodos in his sights and inflicting that much more imaginary pain upon the dead governor. If he continued doing this, it might keep the images of Mijan Bao and Pyotr Nolikov, and especially Belena Ferrosini, from haunting him for just a little longer. "Not the best plan, but for now I'll go with it." Only after he realized the sparring target was no longer reacting to his punches and a voice was calling to him from somewhere did he force himself to stop. His hands aching and his lungs on fire, Lorca drew deep breaths as he stepped away from the mannequin before noticing the pair of wide-eyed crew members staring at him. The pair, a man and a woman, each dressed in fitness attire emblazoned with the Narbonne's name and registry number, regarded him with obvious concern. "Sir?" prompted the female crew member. "I think you killed it." Taking another step back from the training target, Lorca saw that the mannequin was standing at an angle, rocked back off the base, anchoring it to the deck. Indentations from his fists were still visible in the model's chest region, and its face was misshapen and even collapsed inward several centimeters.
"I didn't even know you could do that to these things," said the younger male officer before turning his gaze to Lorca. "Are you all right, sir?"
The ache in his knuckles making him look at his hands, Lorca saw fresh blood soaking through the thin sparring gloves. He flexed his fingers. They would hurt for a while, but there was nothing broken.
"I'm better now."
He really was a far cry from being better, let alone okay or fine. But these two junior officers looking for a workout free from distractions did not deserve to be the brunt of his emotional outbursts. Without another word, he turned and made his way from the gym floor, stripping off his sparring gloves and giving his fingers another tentative flex. The blood there was still oozing, but it was nothing a dermal regenerator could not handle. Moving toward a bench where a towel and a bottle of water waited for him, he noted the figure standing near the doorway on the room's opposite side. Philippa Georgiou. Her face was a mask of concern, doubtless heightened by the sight of his bloodied knuckles. Despite the dull throb beginning to radiate through his hands, he felt better than he had in days.
"Good evening, Commander," he said, exchanging the water bottle for his towel. "Something I can do for you?"
"I was about to ask you the same question." Her tone was flat, but her features still communicated the worry that had greeted him upon noticing her presence in the gym.
"Just working off a little excess energy."
Lorca wiped the towel across his face and over his hair. He stretched his fingers again. The pain was already beginning to ebb. In a few minutes, he might be up for another round with the bag.
Georgiou asked, "Anything you want to talk about?"
Instead of replying, Lorca wiped his face again. As he did so, he noted a trio of obvious civilians entering the gym. He knew that Captain Koropati had offered the use of all of the ship's exercise and other facilities to the hundreds of passengers the Narbon carried, and that the invitation extended to those areas of the ship normally reserved for the crew in order to help with potential overcrowding. There already were a few people, colonists who decided to leave Tarsis IV for transfer to Starbase 11 and eventual transport to some other destination, making use of the gym, and Lorca expected to see still more during the days it would take the ship to make the journey.
"I figured we discussed everything back on the planet," he said after a moment,
and from the look in Georgiou's eyes it was obvious he would not get off that easy.
"And I got the sense you were holding something back."
Releasing a sigh, he sat on the bench, leaning against the adjacent bulkhead as he took another sip of his water.
"You read people pretty well, Commander."
"It's a gift."
Without waiting for an invitation, Georgiou took a seat next to him on the bench.
"So, what's bothering you?"
Lorca released a small, humorless chuckle.
"Everything."
"Give me an example."
Drinking from his bottle, Lorca pondered her request for a moment, and decided there was no reason to be coy any longer. By this point, Georgiou had more than earned a straight answer.
"We should be evacuating the entire planet. To hell with what some of the colonists want. We should pull every last soul from there and relocate them, and then mark Tarsis IV as off-limits. I'd suggest obliterating the damned thing, but even I think that might be a bit extreme."
"At least you'd be waiting for us to get the people up before you pulled the trigger."
"And don't think I didn't consider leaving at least some people behind for that."
Georgiou rested against the bulkhead, crossing her arms.
"Fair enough. As for this idea of yours, what about the people who've decided to stay and rebuild?"
"Screw them."
It was a simple, blunt statement, uttered almost without conscious thought, and for a second or two, Lorca considered offering something to soften it. Then he dismissed that notion before taking another sip of water.
"From this point on, any mention of Tarsis IV in any history book or database will start and end with what happened here. There's nothing left to rebuild, except a legacy of poor leadership, lack of simple damned humanity, and avoidable tragedy, and that's the way it'll be forever. When Georgiou said nothing in response, he added, "It's not just about Kodos, but also the environment that allowed him to do what he did. He didn't act alone or in a vacuum." It was all well and good that those followers of Kodos taken into custody would face justice for their aiding and abetting him. On the other hand, it had taken Lorca a bit of time and reflection to realize that such action only addressed part of the problem. Where the hell did we go wrong? 2 centuries ago on Earth, we damned near bombed ourselves out of existence, and those people lucky enough to survive that still found ways to keep fighting over what was left. We got lucky that the Vulcans showed up and opted to give a shit about us. They handed us a second chance on a silver platter, and for a while there, we looked and acted like we might deserve it. Finishing the water bottle, he tossed it across the room in the general direction of the recycler. It bounced on the floor and rolled toward the far bulkhead. Imagine what those first Vulcans to visit Earth would say if they could see what we let happen on Tarsus IV. What about those who raised hell when we finally decided to take that first warp flight out of our solar system? It's not like we didn't give them reason to worry, and yet they stuck with us. They stood beside us during the Zindi crisis, fought a war with us against the Romulans, and helped us found the Federation because they finally believed we were ready to act like a mature species capable of standing like grown-ups on an interstellar stage. How do we betray that trust? By panicking in the face of crisis and killing 4,000 of our own people because it was the expedient thing to do. The 4,000 people who survived that purge don't deserve the gift of survival they were given.
It wasn't everyone, countered Georgiou. It wasn't even a significant percentage of people on his side.
But there were enough of them. Lorca shook his head. There were those who either believed as he did or found they could live with it because it helped save their own asses. Some of those people are dead, and we took a lot more of them into custody, but you and I both know that hiding among those survivors are people who are thanking deities or random chance or the fact that Kodos found them useful enough to keep alive. Some of them believed in what he was doing, even if they never admit that for as long as they live. Tell me how any of that espouses our lofty Federation values.
Georgiou said, "It doesn't. But you can't blame an entire group of people for the actions of a few extremists. History is full of dire consequences brought on by that sort of thinking."
Sighing, Lorca looked down at his hands as he bent his fingers. The pain was all but gone, and the blood had dried on his knuckles.
"Thinking about another round?" asked Georgiou.
"Yes, I am. At least the bag and I have an understanding."
"If you want to talk, I'm happy to listen."
She pushed herself from the bench, straightening her uniform tunic.
"Don't give up on those ideals just yet, Gabriel. If I've learned anything, it's that after a test like this, we seem to do well at remembering what makes us who we are, and we rededicate ourselves to those things we hold dear in a quest to do better. History also has its share of those stories, and it may well prove you wrong here, too."
Lorca stood. "Believe it or not, I'd be very happy to see that." The smile, small and tired though it may be, was genuine. He admired Philippa Georgiou, who, despite everything she had witnessed on Tarsus IV, still found room to hope not just for the present, but also for the future. Wiping off his hand, he reached into his pocket. He remembered how Belena at first thought it strange when he gave her fortune cookies. It was an affectation he had acquired years earlier, and it became something of a game between them. Later, she insisted the fortune was the best part of their dates. She kept them in that wooden bowl in her apartment and every so often pulled one at random to read aloud. Sometimes she would joke that she was searching for inspiration, or that she was selecting an attitude by which she would face the coming day. It was yet another of her delightful eccentricities. The paper resting in the palm of his hand, Lorca studied the words it contained. "Hate is never conquered by hate. Hate is conquered by love."
It seemed Giorgio and Belena shared the same outlook. One day, Lorca hoped he might feel the same way. 39. Excerpt from The 4000, Crisis on Tarsus IV. Following the departure of the USS Narbonne, other Starfleet vessels operating under the joint command of the Starship Enterprise's Captain Robert April remained at Tarsus IV for another 79 days. Through their work with Governor Ribeiro and the Leadership Council, order was quickly restored, and the remaining colonists attempted to turn their attentions to the future. Part of that process was addressing still important matters that lingered in the aftermath of the tragedy, which required immediate attention if the surviving population was to move forward. While Kodos was killed during the attempt to capture him, many of his supporters were taken into custody. After careful deliberation with Federation legal experts, it was decided that those charged with aiding Kodos to carry out the executions would face trial at a neutral location well away from Tarsus IV. The demands of justice and fair treatment under the law were observed. Separation from the scene of their crime was deemed necessary. All 27 men and women who faced charges were convicted of their roles in the Tarsus IV massacre. Each went on to serve life sentences in a handful of Federation penal colonies. Following the eradication of the fungal infection that ravaged the colony's food supplies and inhibited the production of farming and other food production operations, the effects of the plague would continue to be felt for months. Even after the crisis itself was declared over, memories of what happened here would never truly fade. 10 years after those horrific events, for those who survived the brief yet deadly reign of Kodos, the scars still run deep. Talking with colonists who bore witness to the events of that dreadful night reveals a host of haunted memories. Those who lost friends or family members still speak with great affection and sadness about those whose lives were cut short in such brutal fashion. Even younger men and women who were children on the night of the massacre carried disquieting memories of that time, able to process their individual experiences only years afterward, and with the support of family members, friends, or professional counselors. For anyone who opts to leave Tarsus IV, this almost always invites curiosity once it's learned that person lived through the tragedy or is the offspring of a survivor. Given the state of modern society and the many luxuries we take for granted, unless an individual was caught up in the incident or has a personal connection to a victim or a survivor, there are no points of comparison. The actions undertaken on Tarsus IV, even if motivated by supposed purity of purpose, are simply too far outside mainstream thinking to fully understand or appreciate. Those on Tarsus IV left behind to pick up the pieces of shattered lives found themselves at a crossroads. Many people, either descendants of the original settlers or people transplanted from Epsilon Serona II or other colonies, chose relocation to Earth or another Federation world. However, the vast majority of the planet's surviving population elected to stay. Not content to rebuild just their own lives, there began a growing movement among the community to ensure the massacre, along with the harsh lessons it imparted, was not forgotten. Monuments would be constructed, and memorial services were and continue to be observed each year. Further, there was and remains a concerted effort to make certain such an incident is never visited upon another population anywhere. In the years following the Tarsus IV incident, numerous strides were made in improving adaptability and compatibility testing for plants and seeds transferred between worlds, with an emphasis on verifying agricultural suitability on existing as well as new colony worlds. Thomas Layton, himself a teenager during the massacre, is currently studying to be a scientist, learning to improve farming techniques so that crops from ecologically disparate worlds can be cultivated side by side. Layton, who was not actually among the colonists gathered for the execution, was able to get close enough to the venue to witness the massacre firsthand. Injured during the ensuing chaos, He still bears the marks of his wounds, with the left side of his face covered by a form-fitting shroud to hide mangled flesh and bone as well as his missing eye. For reasons he chooses not to share, he years ago opted against reconstructive surgery to restore his features. "When I'm alone, or if I'm lying in bed before drifting off to sleep," says Leighton in an interview conducted for this book, "I can still see his face and hear his voice. It's as clear as when I heard it that night in the amphitheater." According to the official reports, fewer than a dozen people are still alive today who saw Adrian Kodos on Tarsus IV with their own eyes, so for them, the pain runs even deeper, as they are able firsthand to put a face to the man who inflicted so much pain and fear. Driven to prevent another incident like Tarsus IV from ever happening again, Leighton has spent years devoted to his studies. His successes, along with those of so many others like him, will continue to expand colonization efforts on worlds across the quadrant. New settlements enjoy levels of cultural and technological diversity that could only be dreamed about just decades ago. Not satisfied with these achievements, Leighton and others continue to expand their research into other areas, such as creating foolproof means of combating or even preventing ecological dangers like the plague that ravaged Tarsus IV. For the past 3 years, Leighton has focused his research on developing synthetic foodstuffs in order to curb famine and ensure that nothing can endanger the food supplies or production abilities on any populated world. His work with xenite, a mineral indigenous to the planet Ardana, and primarily used to mitigate the effects of plant diseases on worlds throughout the Federation, has yielded promising results with his new research. Despite years devoted to this effort, Leighton will tell you that it does little to assuage the pain he still feels about the events on Tarsus IV. "Even though they say he's dead, he and the heinous acts he committed are forever seared into my memory. All of it will haunt me for the rest of my days." Disregarding the official reports detailing the fate of Kodos, Leighton is one of a small number of people who wonder if the tyrant really is dead. Having seen all of the information submitted by Starfleet personnel who participated in the manhunt for Kodos and who were there during the final skirmish that brought about his death, people like Leighton still wonder if the story of Kodos really ended 10 years ago on Tarsus IV. The topic is one of moderate popularity in circles that entertain conspiracy theories of every sort, though official circles give the idea no public credence. As for Leighton, he actually eschews such unsubstantiated gossip. "I don't really believe he's still alive," offers the scientist, aware that holding such beliefs might prove detrimental to his work. "But he'll live on in my memory, and the memories of everyone who survived that bloody, horrible thing he did to all of us." USS Shenzhou, NCC 1227. March 16th, 2256. 40. Resting the pad on her desk, Philippa Georgiou leaned back in her chair, eyeing with great admiration the author of what she had just read.
"Well, that was a hell of a thing."
From the couch set against the ready room's far bulkhead, Shannon Moulton set aside the data slate with which she occupied herself while the captain read in silence. She straightened her posture, lifting her gaze to meet Georgiou's.
"Do you really think so?"
"Absolutely."
Georgiou tapped the pad with the fingers of her left hand. "I've read other books about Tarsus IV, and even a few interviews from survivors, but none of them carry this level of personal detail." She laid her hand on the pad.
"This is a wonderful tribute to the living as well as the dead. It's the story they've deserved to have told for 10 years. You did a marvelous job capturing so many different perspectives and memories, and giving the entire narrative a proper balance. Each of the people you interviewed brought something unique to the overall picture you were painting. I admit I was surprised at your inclusion of Fujimura and other Kodos supporters, but after reading the whole thing, I see that you were right to have them represented as well."
It would be difficult, Giorgio decided, for some readers to appreciate the viewpoints offered by anyone who aided or otherwise sympathized with Adrian Kodos, but she believed the proper chronicling of any historical event required insight from all sides of the issue. This includes